All right. This is your Escape from Plan A for this week. It's me and Jess. How's it going, Jess?
Yeah, it's like 2017 through 2022 all over again.
Yeah, all at once.
All at once.
All right, so I got to say, I have been, I don't know if I've been doomer lately, but I've been really like going deep into the, you know, into the shit. And I was like, you know what? I'd like to, let's do a movie review. Shall we? Let's do a film review. Keep it, you know, keep it light. It's hard because like I've told you, I see a lot of movies and they just kind of like, it's like beer. It comes in, it goes out.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And,
I mean, do you watch a lot of movies?
At home? Yeah. I don't go out to the theaters much at all anymore, mm-hmm. but, I watch a decent amount of movies. Yeah.
Okay. All right.
Nothing really does it for me. Lately. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. What about you? Are you like a film watcher?
No, I mean, I mean, the reason why I asked is just, I feel like my personal habits are kind of turning a little esoteric. So I kind of just wanted to like, know what people do. Like, what are people into?
What are the kids into?
What do people even do with their time these days? Like stuff that isn't like doom scrolling.
But you know, what's really, makes me wonder is like, how do people find the time? Because like, I have pretty decent hours, meaning like I don't have like a very long day, and I have a short commute relative to most people. I just jump in the subway. There's no, I don't even transfer. Uh-huh. And then I get home, and then I do a little shopping for dinner. I make dinner. My wife and I eat dinner, and boom, it's almost 9:30. Like, how do people find the time to do anything? Because I'm already like, I'm already super unburdened. You know what I mean? I don't have a lot going on.
Mm-hmm. I think the dirty answer is people don't. I mean, imagine you have like a couple kids at home, right? Then you're and you're feeding them. I mean, I don't have kids either. So I'm just kind of guessing here. But like thinking to my friends who have kids and, you know, how I grew up, my mom worked. I mean, both my parents worked, so it'd be like you eat dinner. That's like then it's usually dark, right? Like 6 or 7, and then like one of them would like help me with homework, or we'd you know, on the rare night there's nothing going on, we maybe watch some TV together or something, and then go to bed. That's it. You get a very, very little amount of time.
But you know, sneaking in dinner by 6 or 7 is pretty good because someone's got to come home and cook that shit after work. Mm-hmm. So someone's got to be home by like 4:30. For that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, the way we did it, it was just like, usually it's my mom who would like pick food up on the way home. So we didn't actually eat a lot of home cooked stuff. Like the days when, you know, like she wanted to make something, or, you know, like, you know, the health food, like fear mongering that was kind of all over the place in the 90s. Mm-hmm. Like she'd come home and with like sacks of like vegetables or something, and then just be in the kitchen, like, and then we'd eat dinner at like 9 or 10. And usually we'd have all like snuck in behind her to raid something out the fridge.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, you just don't get a lot of time.
That's why I think, when you say like, what are you up to? Like if someone asks me what I'm up to, I don't really have much of an answer because what I'm up to is just like, you know, just living. I'm like, I cook dinner and I enjoy cooking. I think that's the thing is like, I rather enjoy it, but now I used to wonder like, how come people don't cook more? Why are people spending so much on like food delivery services? Why are they eating out so much? And I'm starting to really get it. I'm like, okay, even someone like me where I can I took off like before 6 today, which in, you know, in, it's pretty good, I think.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't waste any time. I got home and I started cleaning up and, getting ready for dinner or whatever, and it's now 9:20, and I'm like, oh, no wonder people don't cook. They ain't got time for that shit.
Oh yeah,
it's like a luxury to like. I realize it's a luxury for me to actually be able to cook pretty much every day, and that's like my hobby now is to cook. I enjoy it.
It's a it. I mean, it takes time. and effort. Yeah. Like, yeah. like if you commit to cooking, then you're like committing to cleaning, right? You're committing to shopping. At that mm-hmm. point, that's several hours.
It is, but you know what? It's so important to me in a way because, I really am starting to appreciate being able to control what I eat. Like,
oh yeah, that's huge.
Having real control over what I eat, how much, what goes into it. Mm-hmm. It is definitely out of for health reasons, mm-hmm. But it's also it just feels nice to, actually like touch ingredients and then turn it into food. It's like a nice little act of productivity.
Yeah.
That kind of keeps me like nice and balanced.
That's well put. Yeah, I feel the same way. Apparently like I don't trust I don't trust food these days. But yeah. Also I think my tastes have also drifted. Takeout, even in places that I used to like. I mean, there's all that usual inflation crap, right? Like portions are getting wonky, prices keep going up, so the value for dollar just isn't there anymore. But also, like everything is too much of something in it, or not enough. Yeah. Like Korean food's getting way too sweet for my liking. And it's kind of weird. I think it's because I didn't grow up with a lot of home cookings. When it came to Korea, I have this like weird like barrier in my head, like with cooking Korean food. I feel like
saying
I can't
like the marinades and stuff were too sweet, and there's
everything. Like, well, okay, yeah. Like the other day, like I really wanted tteokbokki, you know, the sticky, the chewy rice cakes with the spicy sauce, like that, and then like I ordered it, and it was basically like it was almost a dessert. Like a slightly spicy
I think I know
dessert.
It's kind of like a spicy sweet sauce.
Yeah.
Right.
Like there was so much sugar and like syrup. They put like rice syrup or something to give it that kind of glossy, like thick texture. But it was so sweet. I couldn't eat it. It just felt completely wrong. And at that point, like what can you do with it? Like you can't really doctor it. So, you know, I just committed to making it at home and I like it much better.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Plus it's a luxury, isn't it? I realize, and it's not a money issue for me. I mean, I think for most people, it's not a money issue because cooking is demonstrably cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a time issue.
Yeah. People like you can measure it in time, right? Like if I was working, especially if you're working for yourself or you're running a company or something, you can't really quantify your time in dollars like that. Like I could be spending an hour doing this or I could be spending an hour doing that. And that thing makes more money than paying 20. Like if making money for an hour I make more in an hour than I would spend. I didn't say that well at all.
No, but I'm getting. Are you saying that you are converting time into dollars or?
I did for like over a decade. Be like, oh, it's not worth my time to go grocery shopping and cooking and then eating it and then cleaning up because you know if you do it right, that can actually be an all day thing, right? To stay on top of every single step of that. Mm-hmm. Whereas if I just convert that same, let's say 5-6 hours into picking up 5-6 hours worth of work or like cranking harder on a project, right? Like. I can quantify the amount of money I could have foreseeably made in that 6 hours. So I would just say like, fuck it. I would just buy food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But that, you know, when I, but like in a salary job, that math didn't quite make sense anymore. Cause I'm being paid the same amount for the amount of time I'm like the dollar amount doesn't actually change. So at that point, you know, then the question is like convenience, right? And now it's really no, like time is the actual wealth here.
Yes.
It There's has no become point. Worth
we
it.
Should,
to
I, I'm
spend
more
it.
Comfortable converting money into time than time into money, you know, in
yeah.
the sense of,
so
if
that's
you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah. Yeah. I'm at that point. So maybe it's not a one size fits all. I think the answer changes depending on where you are in life, but just for right now, that's where I'm at. I'm just kind of curious, like how like common an attitude that is these days.
I don't know. Well, let's talk about it. I think the movie that we've got queued up to discuss, I think, is related to that, which we can see if we wend our way back to it. Mm-hmm. But the film is called Perfect Days. I think it's a 2023 film, so it's one of the current crop of highly lauded, films. I think it won like the best picture at Cannes, I think. I know that the actor, the lead actor won best actor at Cannes. I'm going to look his name up right now because I kind of forgot. I should describe it as a Japanese film because it's pretty much takes place in Japan. It's in Japanese. All the actors are Japanese. But the director is German, Wim Wenders, who I think did a great job. I'm a big fan of Wim Wenders, and Paris, Texas is one of my favorite movies. And Paris, Texas, I kind of feel like he did he made a Japanese movie in the same way that he made an American movie when he made Paris, Texas. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but
no, this is the first. I did not know this director before this one.
Oh well, if you like this, you should definitely watch that movie because it's an older film and it's wonderful. And he's always getting these actors that are just like so good for. In that kind of lead.
Mm-hmm.
Koji Yakusho is the main
That's
guy.
Right, yeah.
And it's kind of a, I don't want to say it's a one man movie, but it kind of is a one man movie.
It's a character study. It's a relatively small movie in terms of absolute scope. It's just done very, very well. Like a portrait in miniature, basically.
Yeah.
I love it.
And there's not much to this film in terms of plot. Like, I think it's kind of it's a bit of like a tone poem type film.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a lot of color. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
It's a little watercolor study of a person.
Yeah, which makes it easy to discuss because I don't think there's really like even much of a like concept of spoiler here. I would be hard pressed to like spoil the movie because, you know, it's not really that plot driven. I wouldn't say it's without plot, but I think we could talk freely about it. Though I would say if you really, really want to go in, you know, without any spoilers whatsoever, I would watch it before listening to all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I had no intention of watching this because I think I saw the trailer as a YouTube ad. You know, when they're, you know, award season, they're really pushing like the trailers for nominated movies and stuff. I seriously thought it was going to be like Yellow Forrest Gump. They really cut this trailer weird.
Oh, really? Yeah.
It has him kind of blissed out. You know, they show him doing like his like menial labor stuff, you know, like the little. But he's all like blissed out. And, you know, it was a very strange trailer in light of the actual movie.
In light of the movie, yeah.
Yeah, because it just shows him like being happy in different circumstances, etc. And it just made him look kind of like out of it or like mentally handicapped, literally.
Yeah. I kind of see what you're saying. Yeah. I mean, even the poster, you know, he kind of looks a little bit touched, you know, where he's constantly looking up with that smile. And should we just describe the movie a little bit?
Describe it and then I mean you recommended it to me. There was something that stuck out about it there's something about it that you wanted to talk about. Let's get into that.
Sure. Okay, so it's about the main character's name is Hirayama. And he's probably in his 50s, I would say, right?
I think
somewhere in his mid 50s. An older man. And we just sort of like get dropped right into the beginning of his day early in the morning. He gets up in the morning. He lives alone in sort of an ungentrified area of Tokyo. I think kind of on the outskirts, it's kind of hinted at. And so he gets up in the morning. He has a very clear structured routine. He's growing these little bonsai trees in his nursery, but otherwise there's no other sign of life in his apartment. Goes downstairs every day, gets a Boss coffee from the vending machine in the parking lot, gets in his little work van, and then drives into central Tokyo. And he's a toilet washer. I guess he works for some service where he just goes around and washes public toilets. Now, this is Tokyo, so these are pretty nice bathrooms. They're like little architectural projects. You know, they're very nice, but
yeah. And like none of them, like it shows him cleaning it, but like none of the bathrooms are just totally wrecked. Everything is still like Tokyo. Like that made me so mad.
I mean, I hate to, I'm ashamed to admit this, but the toilets in this movie are cleaner than my bathroom. You know, and he does his job really well, and it's not like you're not supposed to feel sorry for this guy. There's not a bit of sorrow or oppression in him. You know, it's like he gets up, and I remember that, you know, they focus on his face every morning. He comes out and the first thing he does is look at the sky with a feeling of, you know, you can tell he's such an expressive actor, you know, in the face. And, you know, he's just really looking forward to the day, and he just does everything with such enthusiasm. And I would say there are, you know, extended shots of him cleaning toilets. Like, that's not, you know, like real, we really get in there. You know what I mean? Like behind the seat, he pulls out, he even has, you know, it has a little bidet arm that comes out. You know, this is Japan, so it's super advanced. And they have this little like extendable bidet. And he actually has that thing come out and he washes that too. And, That's pretty much, you know, him, right? And then afterwards, he goes home. He'll go to the public bathhouse and take a long bath and chill for a bit. And then maybe go get some food at a local izakaya-type restaurant. And goes home. He reads some books. He's reading Faulkner in the beginning. Mm-hmm. And then he passes out, wakes up, and does it again. And I think the film follows him over the course of 4 days. And over the 4 days, we slowly begin to learn a little bit more about who he is. We don't learn a lot, but we do learn that he is an uncle to, I think, maybe like a high school-aged girl. She looks to be about high school.
And old enough to hate her mom enough to run away. Quote, run away.
Right. She runs away to her uncle's house.
Yeah.
And her mother is his sister, and we meet her, and that was a really good scene, I thought, because
they packed so much into like a 40-second scene. Like you see that the sister is a woman of some standing. She's got money. She's got like a chauffeured, you know, luxury car.
Yeah.
That he's estranged from his family, and it's implied that, you know, he's living in lower socioeconomic circumstances than maybe what he was born to. And I got that feeling from his living situation too. Like, that's not a great part of town, but that's a well taken care of apartment with a lot of good stuff in it.
Yeah. And everything seems volitional. Like, this isn't a man who's trying to break out of being a toilet cleaner. This is like his choice, and it's clear that he could probably be doing something else, but I think that part of what he likes about it is that he doesn't really have a boss. He's kind of working unsupervised, and he can do it his way, and, you know, there's no office bullshit whatsoever. And there's one scene where he has sort of like there's another younger guy that works with him, and then he quit. And so he has to call the office.
Yeah. Yeah. So Shona, he's kind of a solo player, but he can run things if needed.
And he didn't hold back. I mean, he just lost his temper, and he just called up the thing, and he was just like, either get someone now or I'm not going to do this again.
Yeah.
So he's a liberated guy, right? Like this job is not, despite the setup, like, he's not trapped in this job. He somehow decided to be here.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, it's a small movie. I mean, it's kind of the genre of, you know, what is a life well lived, right? That's the genre of movie this is, right? An exploration of what one guy envisions a good life to be, right? So it shows him like working. He's really good at his job. He's committed to it, but he's not like personally invested in it either. Do you know what I mean? Like it shows him being very thorough, very methodical. He takes his job seriously, but he's not invested personally in that. Like he's got his own interests. He's got his own life. This is a big part of, but not the entirety of. Like his lunch break, he'll take his film, his little point and shoot, and go sit in the temple and you know, take pictures of his tree friend.
Yeah. And then that was structured too. Remember, like he will go and drop off the roll of film like once a month, mm-hmm. or something like that, or once, I forget, it's like once a week. Mm-hmm. And then he'll drop off the film and then he'll pick up his prints from the last week. He goes home, he sorts through each picture, and the ones that are no good, he rips up, and the ones that he likes, he saves into a box. Mm-hmm. And he puts it in his closet, and he's got like archives going back years, you know, of like photo that he takes. So he's really got his life down into a recurring pattern that he mm-hmm. enjoys like thoroughly. Yeah. And then after he finishes his book, he'll go to the same bookstore with the same, you know, bookseller, and he'll pick out a new one, bring it to the counter, and then she will say some little thing about, you know, some little essence of the book for him, and then he takes it home and he'll read it. And mm-hmm. another big part of the film, obviously, is the music. I mean, it's got a great soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Mostly American songs. Mm-hmm. Like Lou Reed and Nina Simone.
Yeah, I revisited some good songs through that soundtrack. You know, there's that he riffs, you know, his niece gives him shit about listening to all this music on a cassette tape. And she gives him shit for not knowing what Spotify is.
Oh yeah.
What's funny
yeah.
is Spotify has the soundtrack for this movie.
Yeah,
so,
really?
You know, I highly yeah. recommend checking it out. You know, if anybody wants to check out some older classics, it's got some good stuff there. I think there's a song by The Cars in it.
Oh, really?
I could be wrong, but just good okay. stuff. Like you said, like Nina Simone, yeah. just really good American classics. And there's a Japanese rendition of that song, though. You know, there's a line about the girl from New Orleans. Uh-huh. I don't know if that's or Brown Eyed Girl, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's really good. So if nothing else, the soundtrack is extremely well put together.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought the movie was good in two parts. Like, one, it's a study of, like, one guy deciding what a good life means to him, what a good life looks like to him, what he needs to have a good life. And the second exploration of that is, like, what does the world need to be able to provide to fulfill on that, right? Mm. So this is a movie where a guy's mainly working alone. He barely talks through the entire movie.
Yeah.
Like, he does a lot with a couple grunts here and there. But it still shows him really plugged into his world. The movie really clearly shows that he's a regular at a couple of like noodle joints. There's a bar he's a regular at. The bookseller knows him. The film guy knows him. So despite like, quote, being alone, he's very much still he's more plugged in than a lot of people I know. He's more plugged
he's
in than
no
I am.
Hermit. He's no hermit. Yeah. Right.
He is very much choosing the level of interaction he takes in the world.
You know, he
but like
said,
everything he needs is there. Whereas I can't say that here. Like if an American in a typical like urban environment decided that what Hirayama has is their idea of a good life, society around them would not be able to accommodate that nearly as well, I think.
Yeah. You know, there's a line in the movie, I forgot where it's said, but do you remember, like, it was said that where they said, like, there's a lot of different worlds? And
I don't remember that. And you could be right.
And he said something like, I live in one world, but there's a lot of worlds. And
oh, you're right. Yeah.
I forgot why he said that. But then, you know, there was one scene that I thought was really good that kind of demonstrated this, was like when he found that little kid inside the bathroom by himself, and he was like, oh shit, this kid's lost. Uh-huh. And so he tells the kid, let me walk you around the park and we'll look for your parents. And then the mother, who's like frantically looking for the child who ended up, because he was hiding in the bathroom, she couldn't find him. Mm-hmm. She comes running out, grabs him away from Hirayama and doesn't even say anything to him.
I know, yeah.
Doesn't acknowledge that he exists.
Yeah.
And then you could tell that the mom is kind of living in a different world. She's like living in this the sort of harried, extremely frantic paced life of a mother with young kids, and she's just I don't think it was necessarily meant to judge her. I think it was just saying that she's on a completely different wavelength, and because of that, she can't even really notice that he exists.
Mm-hmm.
But the kid, as she's walking away, the kid looks back at him and sort of, kind of laughs, and he laughs back. Mm-hmm. So he and the kid seem to be living in the same universe, right? Like in the same frequency. And there's a number of other characters like that. There's that woman who sits on the bench, and she's kind of like, kind of a space cadet. But they're kind of side by side. There's the other guy, like the super crazy guy that does like performance, like weird performance mm-hmm. art. And he's like one of the few people that is acknowledged by this guy.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course his niece, who seems to be totally alienated from the mother and her life or mm-hmm. her kind of life, but really just vibes with her uncle. And so I just thought it was really interesting how he's not a hermit per se. He's just decided to go into like a different frequency, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there are people in that world, and it's just not, just not, I guess, who he was supposed to, who he was supposed to be, perhaps.
Yeah, he gets to choose who he talks to. He gets to choose a level of interaction he takes on. Yeah. I mean, if that's not power, what is, honestly? Yeah. But you brought up something that this was a movie you felt that had something to say about aging. A perspective on it that you don't normally see. I thought that was kind of interesting.
I thought this movie was entirely about aging. I mean, maybe it's not, but that's how I viewed it. And it's about like an older man and how he's navigating, the sort of growing isolation that kind of comes with being, especially him. He's a single guy. He doesn't mm-hmm. have kids, and the world, it doesn't seem to be closing in on him or anything like that, but it does, he is like all people kind of facing down the growing isolation and loneliness of getting older, but he's doing it in a meaningful and successful way that seemed genuine to me, rather than mm-hmm. This being some I could see another director who wanted to tackle such an issue, just sort of like turn it into a thing where you're supposed to walk away and be a bit traumatized or you really learn something about how awful it is for old people out there. And it just didn't have any of that. It was useful.
Yeah, it was actually useful. It was like, what is like, again, the thesis is how to live a good life.
Yeah.
Right. One data point in what it doesn't mean to have a good, fulfilling, purposeful, meaningful, life that has pleasure in it. This is definitely something, right? It shows him having interests, having hobbies. He takes pictures that nobody sees, but it means something to him. He listens to good music on physical media that means something to him. He values it. He values reading. He finds great books at a small bookshop, has a good relationship with the bookkeep.
Yeah.
And then takes pleasure in that. And it's like, at the end of the day, like, isn't that it?
Yeah. I mean, and there's also seems to be like a budding romance kind of thing going on mm-hmm. that he's very cautiously seems to be walking himself into. And we don't mm-hmm. get a lot of it, but we do, when he meets the guy by the river and.
Yeah. The bar keeps, Yeah, the bar owner's ex-husband. It was a very sweet scene.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I, you know, there's that old thing about, you know, you gotta, like, growing as an adult, your the trick is to, like, recapture, quote, childlike wonder or simplicity.
Yeah.
I think there is some truth to that, but I feel like media depictions of that turn it really saccharine, or again, like yellow Forrest Gump
Yeah.
stuff.
Yeah.
I felt like this one was actually like a good depiction of kind of maintaining a sense of like joy in the world, like irreverent fun.
Without turning him into sort of a clown.
Yeah, a clown or like I mean, I really the trailer really had him looking like he had a problem. So the trailer didn't even like whoever cut the trailer didn't get the point of the movie. That's how bad that was. But it actually, but there's some truth to it, right? Like you do want to have some of that like innocence and joy that, you know, children naturally have and that the world kind of beats out of you. But once you get too cynical or self-conscious, I mean, we were supposed to talk about this as a movie about a guy with no inner monologue.
Oh, I want to get to that. Yeah.
Yeah, so we should. So I feel like this is the tunnel in, right? Like, what do children not have? They probably don't have a little overlord voice in their head telling them that, you know, they're stupid and dumb and what they're
Probably
doing is
not.
stupid and dumb and to not do it,
I think that's
right?
right.
So part of that, like, childlike simplicity of being is not having that layer of like self-absorbed or too self-conscious, like self-judgment running in your brain at all times. That's what inhibits you from doing that. So this is, in a sense, a guy who doesn't have that particular inhibition. Like he's very much chosen, like the Tao of his being has been revealed to him and he's living it. That's, you know, that's great.
Yeah, and you know, we were you and I had talked about this where I saw a viral video about inner monologue and how apparently some people don't have any, and this blew a lot of people's minds, and then it blew my mind because I have no idea what people are talking about. I still don't quite understand what inner monologue feels like what is it supposed to mean? I mean, some people interpreted that to mean like, oh yeah, I don't think in words, and that's not the case. I think everyone thinks in words. I mean, can I hear a voice in my head if I want to? Yeah. What I was shocked to learn was that some, I would not say most that I saw, but a lot of people were saying, oh yeah, I constantly have inner monologue. Like I'm constantly just constantly a conversation or some sort of, you know, non-audible but verbal discourse going on in their minds. And I was a bit surprised by that, I guess. And then I realized, okay, I guess is that the difference then? Because since this movie, there's huge stretches where nothing is said. And we're just watching someone go through their day, right? Without talking in solitude, more or less, without really talking to many people, maybe occasionally, but for the most part, this is no words in it, except maybe like the words of a song that he plays in his car or something like that. Compared to, I'm thinking about a movie like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. If people remember that movie with Jim Carrey, it was the Charlie Kaufman script. I forgot who the director is, that French guy. I forgot his name. Begins with an M. That to me is like the epitome of inner monologue, where every moment there was a self-conscious Jim Carrey voiceover saying stuff like, "Oh, why is it every time a girl's nice to me, I fall in love with her?" You know, like stuff like
You
this,
know,
just
actually,
constant drone.
yeah, you brought up Eternal Sunshine, and I thought that was a pretty apt one. But just by coincidence, over the weekend, I watched the movie that is the actual counter flip side, the 180-degree flip side to this one, just by complete coincidence. Synecdoche, New York. Have you seen it?
Yeah, that's another Charlie Kaufman. I think he
Yeah.
directed that, I believe.
I watched the whole thing. Like you've seen it, right?
Yes, I have seen it.
Philip Seymour Hoffman. Do you has it been a lie? Like, do you remember it?
I do remember it, but I don't. I mean, you tell me what what you were seeing.
Yeah. I mean, it just stuck out at me that, like, I mean, it gets very surrealist, and I'm pretty sure I've missed, like, a good third of the twists and turns that this movie takes. But it's Philip Seymour Hoffman, and, you know, halfway through the movie, I was convinced, like, okay, this is the part that made him want to kill himself. Like, this is so depressing.
Yeah.
Because it shows him, like, it's the flip side of this. We're talking about, like, when you're talking about aging, right? Perfect Days is kind of a study in how to do this, I guess, with some amount of dignity, some amount of grace, some joy. Synecdoche is about really all the, like, the opposite of that. Mm. How all the indignities.
And futile. Like, it's so futile.
Yeah, the humiliations, the physical discomfort and infirmity. Like, this guy gets, like, afflicted with, like, 1,000 different ailments that nobody can really give him a good answer on. All of it's kind of embarrassing. His wife is growing, like, distant from him, and kind of humiliates him at every turn.
If I remember Synecdoche correctly, it's about, he's like a playwright, yeah? Or some sort of, like a... You know, he's
a director,
but for theater.
Yeah. So the movie starts with him, like, directing this really kind of very cerebral production of, like, Death of a Salesman. You know, another one about, like, the bleak indignities of the futile tragedy of age, human mortality. Right.
Yeah.
And then it kind of takes it from there, like, just takes them on this really surreal, tortured journey through life, where
it seems like, I mean, it's the funny thing is, I think Roger Ebert said this was his favorite movie of all time, which I was like, what? Are you serious? But it's not a, it's a good universe movie, but I think it's all kind of a horrifying movies. Movie.
Yeah. It's very horrifying. And I thought, like, it just blew me away that, you know, partway through the movie, that inner monologue kind of gets, he kind of gets personified as an actual earpiece in his, because he's a stage director.
Oh my God, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, there's an earpiece in his ear with the woman's voice.
So let's describe the film, because I'm sure most people haven't seen it. If
I don't actually recommend it. It is a very depressing movie.
Yeah, but just to help, like, frame what we're talking about. Yeah, I think that's a very interesting counter, like, to say that that's the opposite of this film, I think is really astute, because if I recall, the boundary between this mega production that he's supposed to, his sort of magnum opus of a play, right, there starts to be a real blurring between his real life and this play that he's creating, so that it seems to be like he's living within the play that he's writing and directing.
Yeah, he's externalizing every indignity, everything that happens to him. He kind of processes it through, like, the medium of his art, you know, producing
which is
a
performance
play.
for an audience.
Yeah, so he turns it into like a piece of theater that he's able to. I guess he's putting some distance. It's a distancing tactic, maybe. So he doesn't like what's going on. So he works through it by kind of creating a scenario where it's this moment in his life is being staged. So he exerts some, like, artistic control over it. But this
play that he creates just gets more and more and more elaborate, to the point where he's basically created, like, an actual living, functioning microcosm of a world, right? Is that kind of like what happens?
Yeah. It's kind of like he becomes this play. It's an all-encompassing, like, the world ends except for his production of this play about his life. It goes on for years and years. Every single detail is endlessly combed over for artistic merit. He stages it, and he kind of revels in the humiliation of his life because, you know, it's all for the play. It's all for his art.
Yeah. This is very Charlie Kaufman. And do you remember, like, he did what's the Orchid? Was it called The Orchid Thief or something like that?
Oh, I remember watching that, but it was so long ago.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything. But, oh, no, Orchid Thief?
The Orchid
Adaptation?
Oh, Adaptation, yeah. The book, yes, sorry. It's
the
called
book
Adaptation,
inside
but
it
it's
is,
of a book called,
Orchid
yeah,
Thief.
It's about a book called Orchid Thief, yeah.
Yeah. It's much about, like, people not being able to properly process themselves as people versus, like, who they are as inner people and outer people, what they do for a living, what they actually stand for, things like that. It all gets blurred, and it's kind of about the psychosis of letting those things blur too much.
But
perfect gaze is about a guy who has everything in its perfect place for him.
Yeah, and it's also, you know, very much about the act of verbalization and thinking, mm-hmm. sort of taking on this, becoming sort of like the supreme process in your life. And mm-hmm. there is a fetishization of sort of like in these Kaufman films of this, the sort of, and I think that's why Giamatti figures a lot into his movies, is like this sort of neurotic, elbow patched sort of, you know, professor at a small liberal arts college or whatever, like a Manhattanite, and it, just very brainy and very sort of like self-loathing and existentially trapped and constantly overthinking things and, you know, whatever. And we somehow find such characters endearing, and that's fine for insofar as gawking at them, you know, like sort of the way we gawk at, you know, a panda falling out of a tree or something. Mm-hmm. But I mean, who would want to be like that? I mean, it's, you know, who would want to be like a Woody Allen type person? You know, I mean, I don't know. Maybe people do aspire to be like that, but I find that to be a kind of awful existence. But there does seem to be, you're right. I think there is, that's a big part of our culture, I think, is that neurotic, is sort of like finding neuroticism charming and appealing in a way.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of the end state, you know, when they talk about unleash, there's a, like pop psychology is all about somehow like peeling the dead layers, like the rotten skin off an onion to uncover the pure goodness inside, right? That's what the, like, unleash the inner, like, king or something in you, right? That good thing that you're looking for is actually deep, deep, deep inside you. You got to unpack all your layers of, like, what, like trauma or conditioning or what, or your own inhibitions or religion or your family or everything. You got to strip all of that away. And then deep, you got to find that pure nugget inside you that's going to be the master, the skeleton key to unlocking the life you've always wanted.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Put another way, it's climb up your own asshole and hope that there's something on the other side of it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. There's this idea that there's this pure inner self that we're all struggling to get to. And society just exists. Like everything in the world, of everything outside yourself, is just a corrupting force.
Yeah.
That's preventing you from getting there. So
yeah, of course, it's just a series of obstacles and frustrations.
Yeah. So you got to dig real deep, just crawl all the way up your asshole. I mean, and I don't think that's really how that works. I really don't.
Yeah.
It's almost like the thing that we're the like ideological therapy package, basically, that's out there in the current ether that we're using to work through our problems is the thing that is predisposing us to actually alienate ourselves. Like, what does that even mean, right? Like, shed everything around you that's preventing you from reaching your highest self. Isn't that another word for alienate the shit out of yourself from everything around you, right?
Yeah. And I think there are attempts in American film, I think, to try and draw that to some other conclusion, to say, okay, the world may grind me down, but, you know, life is all about getting up again, that kind of thing, you know, persistence. Mm-hmm. And another, like, you ever see Sideways? Another Paul Giamatti movie that takes place in like Santa Barbara wine country. Really good.
Yeah, movie. I know what it's about. It's so in the zeitgeist, or was for like a good like 15 years. It's just,
yeah, like it literally really destroyed like the Pinot market, and
it really did. And I'm like
simply because Paul Giamatti said, "I'm not drinking any fucking Pinot," and
yeah, and like that's the Pinot market. Wow, yeah, the power to just tank an entire industry. I was like, honestly, I don't think I could tell a Pinot from a Merlot. I don't think I can, like, not reliably. So, like, what the hell was that about?
Oh, I'm sorry. He cratered Merlot.
Okay. Yeah. I can't tell. Yeah. I know that's a like famous thing. Like some red wine just completely fell out of favor because of this one line pre-meme era moment. So, yeah.
Again, Giamatti, who always plays this guy, you know, he's a high school English teacher who wants to become a novelist, which is a very American thing. And he's written this huge novel. And if you ask him what it's about, he can't really even give you the elevator pitch because it's about everything. Right. And he likens himself, I think, to a pedo grape, you know, as something that's, you know, just incredibly fussy, incredibly sensitive, incredibly hard to nurture. But when you do, something transcendent comes out of it, you know? It's just this very, it's that kind of movie.
It's kind
and in
of
the end,
fun
of course,
that.
He gets frustrated. He gets rejected again by his publisher. His divorce, you know, he gets humiliated and whatever once again by his ex, who's left him for a better man. And you know, it ends with him taking his favorite bottle of collectible wine to like a hamburger shop and eating it and drinking it with, you know, like a crappy hamburger meal. And the point of it being like, you know what, he's gonna try again. He's not gonna give up. Our hero is going to continue trying to write the great American novel. He's going to try to become the writer that, you know, whatever. And that, I think, is like kind of where we are still at as a culture in a way, is like, yes, life is a grind. Yes, life is disappointing. Yes, life is corrupt. Yes, it's frustrating as shit. But you know what it's also about? It's about grit, and it's about, you know, never giving up. And it just, you know, it's just not that satisfying. I'm like, really, that's the best you can do for me? I mean,
it works for a certain kind of like social moment, right? There was a moment in time when you wanted people to have this, right? And there's an actual like real purpose to it. But I mean, these days, I mean, you put that ethos out there, and you know, no wonder the people who rise to the top are the worst sociopaths the world has ever seen. Because what is there to really strive that hard for, that to sacrifice everything like that to pursue a mission? Like, what do we got going on here that's worth that kind of sacrifice?
Yeah.
So the people who find something worthwhile in it, there's some dark answers, and I feel like we're learning this every single day. And the only people who drive are the ones who don't have good motivations at the moment. But it's funny you mentioned Paul Giamatti, because I haven't seen Sideways, but I do really like the show he was on, Lodge 49. I think I told you this.
Yeah,
like
a couple
years ago. He shows up in season two. He plays a writer, a very prolific, very famous, very well respected writer. But the main characters finally meet. Like season one, it shows everyone reading
him,
his books.
Right? He does. Yeah, show up they in do. The- end of season one, I think, right?
Yeah. But they meet him at a mental institution.
Yeah.
So, and he's like, he's still got his like delusions of grandeur and everything. He's, the show kind of he's sacrificed so much for his art. Like he's been celibate for like 10 years. He made that vow to himself. He's going to stay celibate until he finishes his magnum opus.
Yeah. He's playing the same guy.
He's playing the same. It's hilarious. Yeah. If you haven't like season two gets really funny with him in it.
Okay.
But apparently he's just.
I really
he's
like
just
season
been,
one. Yeah.
It's yeah. Really keep going. It's funny. Paul Giamatti's great. Where was I going with this? I think that was it. Just he's been playing the same character a lot then.
Yeah. I mean, all of these things are marked by an excess of dialogue and thinking and talking and observing and being confused and just sort of reveling in nonstop dialogue. And, you know, Tarantino's like that too, right? Tarantino is so famous for his dialogue, movies that were about nothing but dialogue. Mm-hmm. And this film is the opposite. There's barely any dialogue. And I didn't miss it. You know, I realized that there was nothing being said, but I wasn't waiting for it. I was just
really enthralled by watching
this guy go through go through his routine in a way that really, it actually excited me to watch him, you know, go through his day, because I'm like, wow, he enjoys it so much. And then he's got, you know, and he's popping these cassette tapes into his little, you know, old, his old Vanmobile thing, going through Tokyo and just having a sandwich in the park and stuff. And just no part of you feels sorry for him. No part of you is like, oh, what a poor guy making the best of a shitty situation. I was kind of like, yo, I'd like to live in his shoes for a couple days just to check it out. You know what I mean?
Dude, he had a pretty sweet situation going on. His apartment was immaculate.
Yeah.
Perfect vibes, like wood, everything. He's got his vinyl. He's meticulously taking care of his cassettes, his vinyl collection, his books.
Bonsai nursery.
Yeah, the little roots and shoots that he picks up, you know, in his lunchtime walks into the temple. I thought that moment where he had that early on in the movie where he walks into the temple, you know, he gives a quick little bow at the gate and then he sits down. And then there's this moment where he kind of like nods at the I guess Shinto priest. Walkway, and there's kind of a moment, and then he goes,
Yeah, that was cool. Yeah.
And there was kind of a parallel to that. He's kind of living a like modern monkish existence.
Yeah.
I don't mean to say like, oh, fucking incel. No, this is a very like pure kind of existence where he's very intentionally engaging with the world on his own terms, but very much immersed in like the modern world, unlike the priest who's like dressed like, you know, like, the Shogun era, you know,
mm-hmm. but like the monk, I mean, he has clearly turned his back on a lot of things. I think that is true of him, right? Like, he's not just living his best life. He's also clearly rejected and surrendered a lot that was probably available to him.
Yeah, and like the movie makes it clear that there was choice involved. He had a choice. He made some definite choices, and he is very, and those happen to be the good choices for him. This isn't like a story about like Synecdoche. It's largely about this guy getting battered around by life.
Mm-hmm.
He's barely shown with any agency. His wife abuses him. He's not doing great at his job. You know, his own health won't stop bullying him. Basically, he's just keeps. To the point where he has to keep externalizing everything, to the point where, like, at his lowest, an earpiece shows up and he sticks in his ear, and the voice in the earpiece tells him what to do.
Oh my God, that is so perfect. That is absolutely the opposite of this film.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of uncanny. Like, the voice says, okay, now you're going to get up and go to the window and look down at the street. And then on and on, just every single move, you're gonna do this. It's like ordering him. And the very end, should I spoil this?
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, screw it. At the very
end, no one's
gonna
watch Synecdoche. And
shout out if you do. Let me know. But the movie basically ends with like this apocalyptic scene where basically everybody else has died. He just finds the last human on Earth. They have a little like almost meaningless little encounter that's again still presented as part of his like the play he's staging about his life. And while the earpiece gives him basically stage directions for his own like being, and at the end the little voice says, "Okay, now die." And that's the end of the movie. He dies.
Yeah.
The voice tells him to die and he dies.
Yeah.
So it's like at no point did he have like any control or a choice or anything. And the movie's entirely about him like surrendering basically all like power over his life to this externalized voice in his ear that dictates every moment of him.
Which very much sounds like Inner Monologue, and it very much sounds like Freudian superego. And, you know, it is, I've had experience with that. I mean, I remember when I got laid off in like 2017 or 2016 from a job. And, it's not my first time that happened. And every time in the past, you know, I just knew immediately, I was like, okay, you know, this is not time off. Like, tomorrow I'm going to get up at the same time, and I'm going to get, we didn't have WeWork back then, so I went to a library, and I was like, I'm going to go to the library, I'm going to jump on the laptop, and I'm going to start applying to, like, 10 jobs a day until I find something I like, you know, and I actually did that, and it worked. And that time, I was like, nope, I'm going to go home. I'm not going to think about getting another job. And I'm just going to chill. I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to react to this because I wanted to get laid off. I engineered it, you know, and I was like, I'm going to enjoy this. And for the longest time, like, there was literally a voice in my head that would start berating me in the morning for not getting out there and you know, being all that it could be, right? Like, I was like, no, I'm going to fucking chill at home today and not think about it. And I couldn't, like, there was a voice that would compel me, you know, and I had to expend a lot of willpower to ignore that voice. It was hard. And I think I had, like, physical symptoms from that, like stress symptoms, from not listening to it. But you know what? I think I kind of was able to eventually either ignore it or like turn it down or tune it out, because I don't have much of that anymore, I don't think. And I would say ever since then, my life has not changed like drastically at all, but I feel drastically different. And I think one of the things that has changed is everything I do feels more volitional now. I rarely get that feeling of like, oh man, why do I got to do this? I don't. I know I don't have to do it. So it must be that I chose to do it. And that has improved my like moment to moment experience of life, like my moment to moment well-being, you know, immensely, even though my life is fundamentally not that different than it was before.
That makes sense. My thesis is that inner monologue, the intensity of it, is a measure of your disconnect from the life you're living, the world you're in. Mm. I think it gets worse or louder, so to speak, the bigger that fundamental disconnect is. And for me, it doesn't go away. It's just it's more of a friendly presence than a harsh, like Foucauldian panopticon, you know, loudspeaker in my own brain.
Well, in that case, do you still think it?
I do.
Even though it's friendly, like, which I agree. I mean, I think that I suspect it has a lot to do with one's upbringing. And if you were nurtured a lot, I think maybe it's a nurturing voice. Whereas I was like disciplined a lot. So I have a disciplinarian voice in my head. And, but either way, you're saying your thesis is that even a friendly voice is separating you from the world?
Yeah, it's more like my interface layer, honestly. Mm. Kind of like, I guess Jarvis, right? Iron Man's Jarvis.
Yeah.
Right? Kind of that. A thing that I'm outsourcing certain tasks to, so I don't want to be like very consciously doing them myself. Stuff that can be like, that, you know, your collective, you know, your singular AI basically can handle for you, right? Like I'm sure everyone who's been driving for a while knows that feeling. You're just driving home from work or something. It's a very familiar route. You just get behind the wheel and tune out. Like, you don't remember anything that happened on that drive home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you're basically outsourced it because it's so like muscle memory. You don't have to be you don't have to be like excruciatingly cognizant of like every stop sign. You know which lane to turn into before, you know, long before you have to worry about it. You know how to turn, you know where to, you know all these details. You're basically just outsourcing all of that to some little like optimized portion of your brain so that you can be on something else.
Yeah.
But, you know, and if that disconnect between familiarity and what you're doing is bigger, then the more you have to take over that process yourself. So for me, if the voice gets too aggressive or harsh, it just means that I'm in an unfamiliar or uncomfortable place. That can either be, that's a good thing or a bad thing. It's just, it's up to me to decide that. I know like my college years were miserable, you know, like early career stuff was very difficult, personally. So and I think I kind of like wanted to shut out a little bit. So I kind of loaded a bunch into that interface layer. So it'd be literally like I wake up because the voice, you know, like the earpiece in Philip Seymour Hoffman's head is like, get up now. Like the voice in my head would be like, get up now. And I'd get up. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you're going to do this. And then I go do that. And then I kind of like it's kind of a distancing measure. That's why it felt so familiar to see that put up on the screen. It was a way for me to kind of like go through my day without being so personally like enmeshed in it. Like write emails on autopilot, do like whatever BS I'm told to do at work on autopilot. Just it's a way of being on autopilot, honestly. Like forcing myself to go through the motions without being too like personally entangled in it. But the way like but like as that got better, the more it just became like a debugger. Like it just sort of catches me on stuff. I don't know if it's kind of if it's weird that I'm using like software analogies, but it's the way it makes sense to me. Maybe software is muddled in how we think about these things. I don't know. But it'd be like if like I'm just going about my day, but if there's a little like warning light that shows up, then I know that there's something about what I'm doing or what I'm looking at that I need to pay attention to.
Right.
Sometimes it's subtle, right? But that's like that intuition. But
you're describing to me like is very, you know, like low.
It should be normal, I think.
It's not Charlie Kaufman levels of neuroticism where you're constantly thinking about existential issues, you know, at all times. And, you know, I think the problem with that is I just think that a lot of life just cannot or is not meant to be verbalized. Like there is something to be said about like direct, like I guess that's what you're saying, right? Is like direct experience without a verbal intermediation of it, where experience is not decomposed into words, and what happens is just happening, and the experience of the trying to intermediate everything with words, I think, actually leads to a kind of madness, because there are things that words are really well suited for, but I don't think meaning of life and stuff is really all that suitable to verbalization. Do you know what I mean? Like,
it's yeah, just, my brain is not wrinkled enough to process the first half of what you said, but the last bit I agree with, at least. No, I get it.
Yeah, meaning like I think I've always.
Well, it cheapens it a little. It sucks some dimension of meaning out of it to live entirely through that, or to live like in that frame where words are a communication medium, right? So if you're talking to yourself, it's really worth considering, like, who are you talking to and why, right? Like, words are something you use with the outside, something external to yourself to communicate something.
I mean, you could use it internally, too. I mean, there are definitely times, like, I find that, like, if I'm dealing with a problem at work, talking myself through the issues like helps a lot in a way. Like I can't just sit there and think about it like in completely abstract terms. Like I have to put words to certain things and it'll make a lot more sense. And but someone, I forgot who said this, but I always thought it was a really good phrase, was that the mind, especially the thinking mind, you know, like the verbal mind, is a great servant, but it's a terrible master. And I think that's a kind of a good way to capture the idea that like what happens where the thinking mind becomes a master. And that's synecdoche. I mean, like that's the earpiece, mm-hmm. You know, yeah. And I think that's what I really think now that I'm easing into the back half, like I don't want that. I really don't want to be, you know, plagued by thought. I want to think about something when I decide to think about something. And if I don't want to think about anything, I want to have the capacity to not think and just experience and listen to an album all the way through or read a book all the way through, go to bed when I want to go to bed, wake up when I want to wake up, work when I want to work, and not have to be almost like a camel or pack mule to like a never ending, you know, stream of verbal consciousness. You know what I mean?
I do. I can't say that I think, you know, not, you know, I can't, my inner monologue, I stop talking to myself more or do it less if I don't talk like with my mouth to other beings for mm-hmm. long enough.
Wait, say that one more time. What's the correlation?
No, if I just don't talk, like, you know, I can go like a week, let's say, if I can go a week without talking to anybody,
mm-hmm.
I don't necessarily verbalize in my head.
You don't verbalize what? Anything?
I don't, like, that inner monologue kind of goes away.
Oh, if you don't speak.
Yeah.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
I mean, don't you find it, like, if you stay quiet for a long time, don't you find it kind of sometimes a little hard to, like get the wheel back, like, dust the rust off the wheel?
That's the thing. I was thinking about this. The way I think about it, to be honest, is that I am not a person of few words. Like, I will talk your fucking,
Yeah, there's a lot of people listening to this. We're just being like, yeah.
I just run my fucking mouth all the time. My wife and I at home, and we are not a silent couple. Like, we talk all the time, all day, nonstop. And, but see, here's the thing. I think in a way, I don't know that what the neuroscience of this is, but like, whatever, like, you know, neural sub organ that we have that's dedicated to the language function, I suspect that it's a two-way device, meaning like the same device that lets us speak is also kind of interpreting what we hear, I suspect. But in any event, it's our brain. And I think that actually, if you're taking in too much, this is another one of my big theories about what's going on in the modern world. If we're taking too much verbal input, but we're not balancing that out with verbal output, I feel like you're letting the outside forces basically commandeer your verbal chip. And that might lead to, I suspect that might lead to a lot of like uncontrolled inner monologue, you know, the earpiece.
To be honest, I wondered this about the rise of podcasts.
Perhaps, yeah.
Perhaps. So, you know, like,
but it's we're not sitting just podcasts, on one. It's also television. It's also just being inundated with media of any sort.
Yeah. I mean, in the current day, then, like, I often did wonder, you know, podcasts definitely had this big moment, right? I don't know if they're, I don't think they're nearly as big as they were, but, you know, for the last decade or so, they were pretty dominant. But, you know, a lot of them are just, you know, overhearing people talking. And, you know, I've definitely had moments where just listening to other people talk about this stuff, it was kind of a substitute for me talking about it myself.
Yeah, I think that might
so. I think it is a substitute. I think so too. The irony.
Not that listening to other people's dangerous, but this. I think you got to balance it out with your own speech. Like, you've got to talk. So I guess what I'm saying is, I'm.
It's not a substitute, and it can be a kind of a crutch, or like a warning. Like, I don't know. I feel like people who maybe rely on podcasts too much, like, there's something going on. And what too much is probably, it varies from person to person, but like, I knew people who would basically like only ever listen to podcasts like all day, every day.
Yeah.
At that point it's like, well, like, do you want to actually like talk about this stuff or like what? Unless it's an actual education program, you're literally just listening to people kind of shoot the shit about a loose subject.
Which is not a problem. The only problem is you can't talk back.
Yeah,
you it's know? A one-way conversation. So I am not anti-conversation at all. I'm very pro-conversation. I'm very pro-talking. What I am weary of is exactly what you're talking about. I am weary of taking part in too many conversations that you cannot engage in yourself. Because I feel like what you're doing actually, in a way, is you're surrendering control of your verbal faculties to outside forces. And I suspect that's where problematic inner monologue might come from, is people who have a extreme trade deficit in terms of like words. They're importing far more than they're exporting.
Yeah, it probably is like one of the plagues of the modern day.
Because, I mean, if you think about it, it you makes sense, work, right? It was like
you're talking to your coworkers, and what can you really say to your coworkers? You have a limited amount of interaction there. Most people don't, you know, like, I don't know, for a while there, like, I wasn't even really talking to, like, my friends. They were all busy with their families or got their own stuff going on. So for a very long time, you know, my social interactions were kind of constrained. Like, you don't really know, like, so relying very heavily on, like, basically overhearing other people's conversations. Maybe that's why podcasts aren't what they used to be, or they just aren't as popular anymore. Like, this is just, like, the collective being like, you know, we're done with this part. We're doing some talking now.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't really given that much thought, but, I mean, perhaps. The going back to the Hirayama and this film, I wonder if you could see this as someone who's trying to escape sort of like a kind of verbal, like a verbal panopticon, you know, like he might just himself be a man of few words. Like he doesn't seem like he really wants to talk that much. Mm-hmm. But the problem with a man like that is if you're not really of the nature of someone who wants to talk a lot, then you kind of have to make sure that you're not being talked too mm-hmm. much either, because I feel like you're very vulnerable to over talk. And I suspect that might be like why his character, I'm not saying that this was intentionally written, but I do think that it's consistent with like real life. And I think when you write characters that are supposed to be like real life, like I wonder if these things just sort of like naturally make their way in. Is a man a few words needs to live a life that's not a man or a woman that's of a few words needs to live a life that is itself like somewhat a little bit silent, if that makes sense. Like, do you know what I mean? Like if you're not prepared to talk a shitload, then you should try and limit how much you have to listen to, you know?
Sensible. Yeah. I mean, you know, in like the old monastic orders, if you take a vow of like silence or, you know, or whatever, you cloister yourself, you basically sequester yourself away from mm-hmm. the world. Like, what are you going to take a vow of chastity if you work in a brothel? Mm. You know, so you have to somewhat remove yourself from that circumstance to be able to fulfill on that vow.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, it just was very nice to see that, you know, it's a small life, but he's chosen every element that he allows in it very deliberately. Like nothing is there that isn't good for him that he hasn't decided, you know, should be in. Mm-hmm. To the point where he doesn't even like it's shown. It's not supposed to be some portrait of a perfect man. His sister kind of calls him out saying like our dad's in the hospital. He's dying. He's losing his mind. Aren't you going to go visit? And he's like, yeah, no.
Well, I thought that there was a little hint of maybe some, like an abusive relationship.
It's left very ambiguous, like, yeah. But on its face, it's an appeal to be, you know, an appeal to like filial piety or just being like connected to family.
But remember she says he won't act like he used to.
Yeah, no, I get that. Like, it's left very, very, like, it's clear that there's some shit that went down. Like, not saying that he didn't have his own reasons. It's just on its face, it's a sister saying, like, he's dying. That's a, you know, like, quote, normal human interaction is, you know, you visit. On its face, the good thing to do is to take care of your dying parents, right?
Yeah, but I think she was getting pretty close to, like, his real vulnerable points. You know, because like he was, that was the first time, like when she left, that was the first time we see him really experience. He gets thrown off his game. You know how he gets kind of gets thrown off his game from that?
Yeah, it takes a minute to recover.
To recover,
equilibrium.
Yeah. And then that last scene, which was, I thought, excellent. I don't know how other people, I don't know how you reacted to it, but I thought it was really great how he had that expression, a very dynamic expression where like, he's driving, the sun's coming up, he's going to work, and he's just having this clash of, you know, emotions or something's going on where he's kind of crying but also having like this joyous ecstasy at the same time. And I don't know what you thought about that as an
I thought it was really beautiful. Like the control this actor has over every little muscle in his face.
Good. Yeah, he's so good.
I mean, it's one single shot, right? So it's an incredible shot. But and I hadn't really thought of the connection before, but that ending sequence is exactly like I don't know if you've seen Pearl.
I've not.
It's interesting. It is quite interesting. It's the prequel to another movie called I think it's just called X.
Yeah, I hated that movie. It was so gross.
It was gross. But Pearl kind of reshifts the focus. It becomes a little bit more intelligible after this. Pearl is by far the better movie too.
Okay.
I
mean, I liked Ty West. I just didn't like that. I didn't like X. But
I didn't really. It started off strong and slowly just like really lost the plot, I think. Pearl is the far superior movie.
Mm-hmm.
But it's almost exactly the ending sequence of Pearl. It's this this girl who's like literally gone insane, just going through like a whole range of emotions in one very painful close-up shot of her face.
Yeah.
Like,
but you think that's what's happening to him? You think he's kind of going insane a little bit?
No. Well, maybe. Or he's going through something, right? You're being invited to like to look at it, but you're not really supposed to know everything because what's inside his head is his. Mm-hmm. You're not supposed to see inside his head. You get to look and come away with whatever you want to come away with. They're not going to tell you what to think about it. But it's kind of the inverse for Pearl. Like you're being invited to witness this girl's like complete mental fracture.
I actually thought it was the opposite, where what we were witnessing was, someone who has found like a very stable peace. And what I saw, which I have no idea was the intention or not, but the way I related to that was, this was a guy who has apparently some sort of like, you know, some very painful, maybe memories or something like that, experiences that he doesn't like to talk about or think about very much. But clearly when those things are brought to the surface, like when his sister visits and brings up the father, it all comes back to him and he's not really prepared to handle it. But he gets up in the morning again, right? His day starts over. He remembers his routine and whatever. He puts on his janitor suit. He puts that towel around his neck, which for some reason, did you find it? It just seemed very protective. I don't know why. Like, I was like, oh yeah, he's got the towel around his head, his neck. It'll be fine.
Okay.
But it seemed to me kind of like, all right, this guy's found his peace. It's kind of like, it's almost like when lava erupts underwater. You know, it's like,
oh, okay.
It's, yeah, that's some pretty hot shit that's coming out of the ground, but it can't compete with the ocean. You know, like it comes right out into the ocean. There's a lot, there's hissing and bubbling and stuff, but the ocean wins.
Okay, so yeah,
That's how I viewed it, was actually this guy has found peace. And at that point in that, as he was driving, he was confident enough in that he was going to let it out, but he could still go to work. He could still just run through his day. Mm-hmm. And the smiles were winning over the tears in my,
I got that. Yeah. Yeah. He does go through some like shadowy valley of the soul, a dark night of the soul.
Mm-hmm.
And then comes out the other side.
He's winning. I think the light side of this is winning. Mm-hmm. And I heard some critics talk about, oh, you know, it's how life is about both, and it's about the you know, the duality. And I was like, I don't know. I think it's a little simpler than that. I think he's actually just winning. Like, I think his formula is winning in the sense that he has found like a certain kind of connectedness and rootedness where all he can actually now stop trying to suppress all this shit about his father or whatever it is, or maybe that woman, you know, maybe whatever was going on with that woman, and let it out. And he's not gonna fall apart. He's gonna be fine.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. It's just, It made me think of Pearl just because it was so like it's a pretty stark depiction. Like, and Pearl was the first time I'd really seen that used to very uncomfortable effect.
I mean, just like a super close up of a person super just going close through something. Up. Yeah.
It's actually a spectacular final shot. It's a pretty good movie. And then it made me think like, huh, actually that movie's an exploration too. Of a kind of a similar theme. Like the big line in that movie is Pearl, the main character, lashing out, shouting, I will not accept a life I don't deserve. But it's like it's her fighting against destiny, basically. She cannot accept the life she's been given, and it's a horror. The horror is, you know, that destiny can be very unfair.
Right.
You only get to choose how you react to it. She happened to choose a very not good way to manage it. Like, the success she's dreamt of, the life she dreams of, is not going to be possible, and she lashes out.
Yeah. All right, I'll check it out. I don't have much to say about it because I've never seen it, but...
I mean, it was described as a... Like, after I saw it, I looked at... You know, I read about it, and someone described it as Joker for women. Mm-hmm. And I was like, I actually have... That's actually pretty good. Yeah, okay. I actually kind of agree with that.
I like Joker. But I thought
it's very much like fighting. I mean, it's definitely, but the theme that connects like Pearl to like Perfect Days here, it's like it's very much like it's another exploration of like, well, what would a good life constitute? In Pearl, it's, you know, the usual material stuff that we're told is quote good, right? She dreams of like being a star, right? Being rich, being famous, being adored, like stuff like that. And then the movie is like an exploration of what happens if when those dreams get thwarted one by one. Mm-hmm. Like, she's not as talented as she, you know, she needs to be to make that life. It's not about like she's this like shining star just oppressed by her circumstances. No, she's just like not, she doesn't have quite what it takes to get to where she wants to be. Like, this has nothing to do with being oppressed. Just, she doesn't have it.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you can't want it, right? That's the tragedy of
it. Our boy Hirayama is sort of the opposite. Seems like he could have been more than this, but he chose not to.
Yeah, so they're kind of like, these movies are kind of like these three pieces between like Synecdoche, Perfect Days, and like Pearl. It's kind of like exploring the same question in a different way. And what happens if you make bad calls? What happens if it goes wrong? It's tragic. This is like the ultimate tragedy, because this is, we're talking about a life ruined or wasted.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, it sounds like it's two thumbs up from us for this movie.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
I highly suggest people watch this. Personally, like, it's not that I relate directly to this character. You know, he's a very particular kind of character. But I would say that the element, I told you this before, like, I do think like the basic elements or ingredients of this film, like, are the same, are very, very similar to like My Life. If you know what I mean, like, you know, the people are not the same, but like the certain things pop up that just made me think like, holy shit, this movie's actually talking to me, you know, like when his sister shows up and then they've got this family thing going on. I mean, I told you about my whole thing last year with my sister and my family and my parents and stuff. Now, it wasn't the same issue as apparently whatever's going on in here, but I'm saying like the basic elements were the same. Like, I really empathized with the pain that he felt, which probably is a lot more, you know, at least the way it was written was a lot more than any, you know, my experience. But it was still like that same feeling, you know, like you're getting older and there's still these unresolved family, you know. You just wonder, like, you know, how come we can't just be better? How come the four of us can't just choose to be better? Like, one of us is always choosing to fuck things up. You know what I mean? Like, that kind of thing. And it's just very frustrating, very painful. And watching it, I was like, you know, I'm so glad someone made this movie. You know, like, I'm just like, so thankful to just watch it and just be like, oh, okay, what I'm experiencing is just life. Like, that's just what happens, you know. So
yeah,
it was great. It was one of the first movies I've seen in a long time where I was like, Jess, you gotta watch this movie. I was like, we gotta talk about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, you don't say that too often. So as soon as you did, I was like, really? The Yellow Forest Gump shit?
Yeah, right? Yeah. All right.
I trust you. Yeah. 8 years of doing this and you've earned a little trust. Sure, yeah, I won't
lead you astray with some yellow face Amelie bullshit.
It just has him like smiling blankly it off into the middle distance.
Yeah.
And like him like blissed out riding his bike.
Yeah.
It was like, what is this?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, the another movie that I think is like overly, from my perspective now in life, I'm not laying judgment on this movie. I'm just saying like, it's not like this, was Chungking Express. Like everyone loves Chungking Express. Everyone loves the Wong Kar-wai movies. And I think Wong Kar-wai, that's another one. That's another whole set of films that I think indulges in neurotic voiceovers and narration. And, you know, in my personal view, is very far from the direct experience of life. It's very mm-hmm. much a movie of the mind, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know why.
Yeah, and as far as it talks about aging, it's like the diametric opposite of like, as far as aging as a meta theme in media, it's like a 180 from how it's depicted, usually depicted in America. In America, it's like, it's always like aging is okay, quote, comma, if you still got, quote, it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's like, wow, Jennifer Aniston looks great.
Yeah.
You know, she still got it. She's 54 and crushing it. She's still fuckable. Like, you know, it's that kind of thing. Or if it's an aging man, then it's like the Expendables, right? Where they dig out every aging, you know, A-lister from the 70s, put them on. Like, you can practically smell the Bengay coming off the screen, right? Yeah. Like, everyone's like bad. 70 and ripped, like, yeah, in a very uncomfortable looking.
And
it's
like
very
so much
weird.
Plastic surgery, like Sylvester Stallone can't even move his face anymore. It's just
awful. Like, it's yeah, it's uncanny. And they made like 10 of those movies.
Yeah.
I remember the first one came out and like they, like, their hearts are gonna give out, man. They're not gonna. And then like we're like at Expendables 7 or something.
Yeah.
It's insane.
Yeah.
So that's aging. Like it's either you go to extraordinary superhuman expense, which most people, and like investment of time and money, which most people can't even do, right? Mm-hmm. To preserve quote it, right? And that makes aging okay, because you technically, aging is okay if you don't look like you've aged, or you still can do stuff that younger people can do.
Right. Exactly. It's not embraced. And, you know, it really pisses me off that that's the way the culture is, because I'm experiencing aging now and mm-hmm. I love it. I think it's great. Yeah. You know, and
yeah. Or the flip side is like going into agonizing detail over all the indignities of aging, right? Like the yeah, physical ailments, you know, life being disappointing. You know, that was kind of one of the sub themes of Synecdoche, right? Like a mm-hmm. middle-aged man just kind of getting battered around.
Yeah, this like is the thing that I hate about our culture is like there's
the fragility of his being. Like he's kind of overweight. He's just kind of as a person.
It's
yeah,
so stupid. And there's an inbuilt, And I don't struggle with this, but I sense it, you know, like I don't care about it, but I do sense it, that the culture itself feels ashamed of aging.
Mm-hmm.
There's a certain shame that goes with aging, and people are very sensitive about the topic.
Yeah, it's a kind of failure that, you know, you have to kind of just deal with.
Yeah, and then it's like, you know, and then you're supposed to dunk on yourself and make fun of yourself for being old and
mm-hmm. or forgive yourself. Like that's a yeah, like Diane Keaton rom-com basically.
Yeah.
Right? And with the gorgeous well-lit kitchen or something, but it's like you're accepting yourself, you know, despite this infirmity or something.
Yeah, and it's not even that I disagree with it on some sort of principle level, but I just don't experience it that way.
Yeah.
Like I don't feel any of that at all, you know? And at first I was like, maybe I'm just being in denial of this, or maybe I'm being contrarian, or, you know, like I'm just, you know, whatever. And then no, I don't think so. I mean, I think that if people made more cultural works that understood this, which I think this movie does, you know, people would have eventually changed their view on aging. You know, but I do still think right now, fundamentally speaking, we have a very kind of sad relationship with it. And I'm like, that's half your life. It's half of your life. It's the second half of your life, you're already kind of writing off, you know? So what is the point of that? I don't get it. It just seems so self-defeating. And the roots of it seem so corrupt that I am trying to take a stand against that in my own mind, to be like, reject it. It's bullshit. It's corrupt. Don't listen to it. It's crap. And I think the existence of such a film means that I think other people understand this too very clearly.
Yeah, I'm glad that it got the attention it did. I mean, one thing that it stands very, very firmly against is like this cultural imperative we have to be seen and heard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, and this guy here, he's living this great small life, intentionally invisible and unheard, literally. Yeah. Right. Like, that's the thing about aging. I mean, I read works by, like, older women, and I'm not saying that they're wrong for doing this, it's real, right? Saying that one of the hardest parts for them as aging women is invisibility.
Invisibility, yeah.
Like, men don't check them out as much. Like, they switch from, you know, miss to ma'am, you know, that transition, you know? They lose standing as, like, a visible, aka, like, sexually viable person in the world.
It sounds like every other article printed in, like, New Yorker or
something. Yeah, yeah.
You know, and it's just like when is it ever going to end?
The invisibility of aging, right? And but then when we think about that, like, okay, if that is a problem, then the only thing that we're equipped to do is say, okay, we just need to make it more visible.
Right.
You just need to be out there. You need to be seen, and other people need to see you. Yeah. That's the solution to this. And
let's just say I've seen a lot of collagen injections go wrong, and I think it's in pursuit of that kind of view of things, you know. So
I mean, it's not to judge the people who get it, like it's real. The fear of that is real. And if you're embedded in a culture that values like being seen and heard and values people by how much basically, you know, audience they can drum up, basically, right? Mm-hmm. Then of course you're gonna feel like you have to do this just to keep your head above water. But here's this nice little like vignette of a guy who keeps himself very like how good a life can be if, you know, invisible and unheard.
I think there is also aspects of this movie that are very uniquely Japanese in that as opposed to, you know, either German or American, in that he exists in a culture that will play along with him in this. Like, mm-hmm. he's not alone. Like, there is a lot of communal, there's a lot of connections for someone like him to just have in everyday life. Just, you know, going to take a bath or do his laundry or go eat. And, you know, the guy at the restaurant recognizes him and always thanks him for his hard work. And then he goes to that other restaurant with the lady that he's kind of, you know, kind of crushing on, and, you know, and it's a whole little family inside that restaurant. Mm-hmm. And he can also ride his bike anywhere and just leave the fucking bike there.
Oh, I know. It's disgusting. It's fucking
that
disgusting.
That is filthy. I can't believe people are allowed to do it. But like, it is true that I think, you know, one sadder aspect of this, I looked at it and I'm like, yeah, America's not like that at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it's very hostile compared. It's like he lived in what seemed to be, to me as an American, to be an extremely nurturing and cooperative society for someone like him. Whereas here, you got to be a little bit of a prepper. Like you got to be more Charles Bronson than Hirayama in America. You know what I mean? So
yeah. It's saying like he chose a very deliberate life for himself, but he had a lot of like social wealth to choose from.
Yes, yeah, for sure.
We start with fewer options.
Yeah.
I couldn't build that shit if I want. There's no amount of money I can make that buys me that life either.
Yeah. Yeah. So
it's just another world.
Yeah, I mean one real joy of this is just watching him like live in Japan. You know?
I know.
And just the lifestyle that he's able to lead there, and it seems such a breath of fresh air compared to the daily grind in America, I have to say.
Yeah.
So should we leave it there? I think that was a pretty exhaustive review of a wonderful film, Perfect Days by Wim Wenders. Go see it. I think it's still playing in theaters here in New York. I was able to find a copy online. But I am going to try and see it in the theater. So
that would be pretty cool. Yeah.
I'm sure it's playing in LA too somewhere.
Yeah, I'm sure it is. It's just, oh, I got to go outside. There's people out there.
I hope to like review, you know, like, I hope to like talk more about like films and books and stuff, you know, like.
I'd like to get into that. Yeah. There's not much I have to say about the news anymore. I feel like I got that all out of my system. It's like, yeah. Oh, great. Yeah. This shit again.
Yeah.
Well, it's just not worth the effort.
I mean, it is. I'm not discounting it. I'm just saying, like, it seems to be repetitive, you know. And there's a limit to how much you can even really get out of it.
Yeah, at some point, it's just either like a temporary little bit of like catharsis, mm-hmm. but then it just starts up again. So it's like it's just yet another dopamine flywheel for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm absolutely saying, like, I try not to think too hard about it because there's just. There's other things I'm interested in. I'd rather just take a grip on those and talk about it. Just, I have nothing to say about politics anymore.
Yeah. Well, looks like we're on the same wavelength. You're like that. You're like Hirayama and I'm like that crazy dude, like homeless dude. And we're kind of pointing at each other.
We're vibing. We're vibing.
I see ya. Now I'm going to go back to doing performance art on the hill.
Good public. For you, man. let that plastic bag fly, all buddy.
Right. All right. That was fun, Jess. All right. Thanks for listening. As always. We'll see y'all next week. Bye.